Oh, wait. Good morning. This is John Richardson speaking with you from Toronto, Canada. Today is Thursday, March the 17th, 2022. And I actually interrupted my listening to Commissioner Rettig testifying before the Ways and Means Committee about the high cost of administering the Internal Revenue Code and running the IRS. In other words, the massive costs associated with the current U.S. tax system, which makes my guest today not only important, but particularly timely. I'd like to introduce to you Mr. Jim Bennett, who is a mover and shaker and organizer in the Fair Tax movement, and you will find the information at fairtax.org. And this is, I think, of significance to all American taxpayers, but I think of special significance to Americans abroad, because one of the results of moving to the Fair Tax system would be the total elimination, at least as far as I can see, of the nemesis of Americans abroad, that is tax residency generally, and the way that the U.S. defines it in terms of citizenship. So, Jim, welcome. Thank you so much for meeting with me today. And by the way, a special shout out to Joe Howard for organizing this. How are you?
Thank you, John, for having me on. I'm great, and I appreciate being invited onto your show. I think this is very timely for both of us.
Absolutely, it is. If you didn't have such an impressive resume, I probably would attempt to introduce you a little better myself. But since I want to make sure that I don't mess this up, I'd like to invite you to give a little bit of your background, your resume, your interest in this area, et cetera.
Oh, sure, Joe, and I'll keep it brief. I graduated from New York Law School with a JD, and immediately after that, I had a military commitment, and I went to Germany as a captain, and I was in the Judge Advocate General's Corps for 3 years. I handled administrative law. I handled criminal defense. I handled legal assistance, and I encountered some very issues that many American attorneys don't have the opportunity to confront. Now, let me get into the point that I think is really going to be of interest to your listeners who are expats abroad. I was one of the 0.1%, I would estimate, of military personnel who got out of the Army and stayed in Germany. I had an offer from a German insurance company called Gerling Concern in Cologne, and I had to fly to Fort Dix to get discharged, and I hopped right back on a plane and went back to Cologne. So I experienced firsthand, upfront and personal, the things that you people are experiencing right now, with perhaps two salient exceptions. One was in the 1970s when this all happened. We didn't have FATCA, so I didn't have trouble as an American citizen opening up a bank account. But number two, I wasn't able to vote for federal candidates in American elections. So I was basically someone who was paying taxes to the United States, but being disenfranchised from the vote. I maintained no residence in the United States until 3 years later, the company transferred me to downtown New York, where we started a liaison office, eventually made it into an insurance company in New York. And that lasted 4 years. Then for 6 years, I went to a competitor, the Colonia Insurance Company, which is also a German insurance company. Then for 9 years, I had a private practice. And for almost 20 years after that, I was a deputy attorney general with the New Jersey Department of Law and Public Safety. I was on the civil side, and that's the job from which I retired. And I've been retired for almost 4 years now. Now, how did I get involved with this thing called the Fair Tax? My father once said that sales taxes were a more efficient way to collect revenue for the government than income taxes, because it requires less infrastructure, But I had no idea until one fine day I was driving up the New Jersey Turnpike and I was listening to this radio talk show host named Neil Bortz. And I had no idea who he was. He's not in my area, but apparently in Atlanta and Northern Florida and everywhere else in the United States, except New York, Washington, Philadelphia, and Boston, he's a household icon. So he was talking about this thing called the fair tax, which is basically a national sales tax. And knowing what I did, I said, I've got to get involved. So probably to my wife's chagrin, I've been involved in that ever since.
So would it be fair to say that actually you, when you say you retired, you mean you retired from remunerative employment, but really upped your game and your passions? Would that be a fair statement?
That would be a fair statement, particularly if you talk to my wife. She doesn't think I'm retired.
I don't think I'm retired either, know, the way it sounds. I mean, you know, you've got, you know, just the way you talk. I mean, there's a real passion there, you know, which is great. Okay, so just a few things. Now, the first, very, very, very brief, and this is just my own personal interest, so very brief. The way you describe your career as a lawyer in the mill, is that a JAG lawyer? Is that what's currently?
Yes.
Okay, thank you for that. All right, I just wanted to know. Okay. All right, that's actually, you know, I've met not a large number, but at least a hand's worth, five fingers worth over my life. And that seems to be great, great training for lawyers, actually. Is that true?
I think you're right. We get trial experience early on. I know that associates who go into big top drawer law firms tend to get the back room and have very little client contact. We had trial experience in criminal law, so at least I learned how to move things into evidence and things of that nature. And overall, it was valuable, and also living in Germany and learning the language. So I became fluent in German, and we have friends to this day.
All right. Now, just a second thing triggered by your mentioning that you were living in Germany. So I gather that you were covered by the SOFA treaty when you were living there, which basically meant that you were hands off for German tax residency purposes.
That's correct. While I was in Germany, I was hands off. But for the following period, I was very much hands on.
Uh-huh. Okay. Now, for that following period when you were very much hands-on, it meant that you were actually a dual tax resident, I guess, of Germany and the United States.
Yes, sir. Oof. And what I learned was that first of all, as I understand now, we are one of two countries in the world that tax our expats who maintain no residence in the United States, the other one being, as I understand, Eritrea, which doesn't have much significance in the overall economic picture. I think the Philippines did, because when they became independent, they inherited our tax code, but they got rid of that. So the problem was that we got the worst of both tax worlds, as I think you know that. And just to use a very basic example, let's say my currency back then was Deutschmarks. If I won 1 million Deutschmarks in the South German lottery, that would have been tax-free in Germany. But since I had to deal with the United States, that was taxable or reportable as income in the United States. And let's look at the flip side of that. If I bought tax-free munis, that would be tax-free in the United States, but it would have been reportable as income in Germany. So either way, you just couldn't win.
It's not a pleasant a world to live in, is it? The idea of being a dual tax resident, and that's why that's why tax treaties, as you probably know, have tiebreak provisions to assign tax residency to one country or another. It's just that, as you know, U.S. citizens can't take advantage of them, right? Because of the way the treaties are written. So this is a really serious problem, and it's gotten very much aggravated beyond even the things you describe, since the 70s, to be sure. But okay, so let's talk about what the fair tax is. I mean, I think everybody listening to this podcast, in fact, I think everybody in the world, even if they don't, it was an Einstein who said it was the most difficult thing to understand was the income tax, but by God, he knew what it was. So, I mean, I think everybody knows what it is, even if they don't understand too well how it works, other than that it means trouble. But, I mean, let's back up a little bit, right? So a tax system conceptually really doesn't have to be any kind of tax system. But, I mean, let's start. Part of the problem with tax systems is they're now about so much more than raising revenue, right? You know, they're now to influence people in this way or the other. But let's say we just start from the presumption that a tax system is supposed to raise revenue. An income tax, I suppose, does that to some degree. The United States has always been very weak on sales taxes, I think, at least compared to Europe, right? You know, where you've got these huge value-added taxes. Canada has significant value-added taxes. So your view of this, the fair tax view of this, is to basically transition the country away from the income tax and onboard sales taxes in a really significant way as a replacement, correct?
Yes, John. Absolutely, because we think that the income tax, first of all, is opaque. Nobody understands it. It's an inefficient way to raise revenue for the government because you have to have this big infrastructure called the IRS. It's a dead weight to the economy. It's unfair, and people on both sides of the aisle agree that the income tax is unfair. They just agree for different reasons as to why it's unfair. And to throw in a couple of bonus points, the income tax is intrusive and it's discriminatory. So let's bring in the fair tax.
Before we go to the fair tax, just hold there for 1 second. You know, you're saying so many interesting things at once. I mean, I agree the income tax is unfair, and I agree that people see different kinds of unfairness in it. But I wonder if you could just describe one or two areas that would illustrate why you think the income tax is unfair.
Sure. Well, for one thing, most of the fair tax constituents are convinced that one shouldn't be taxed on the fruits of one's industry. Now, what the income tax does is it taxes the products of two things, capital and labor. And so if we exercise fiscal constraint and we're able to save money and not consume everything that comes in, then the fruit of that would be either interest or capital gain. And the income tax taxes that, and it discourages that activity. And also the income tax discourages labor, so that, and because of the progressive nature of the American and I think also the Canadian income tax system, the more money one earns, the higher the marginal tax rate, and so one is actually penalized for earning more. So that would be our side of the argument. Now, obviously, people on the other side of the aisle think that people who earn more don't pay enough tax. And we have some answers for that. But basically, the income tax is, both sides agree that it's not a fair system and we could do better.
And on the discriminatory, you also use the word discriminatory. Interested in your thoughts on that. How, why is an income tax or the income tax that in America discriminatory?
Well, that's a very good question, John. We think that the income tax gives certain tax breaks for certain things that the government thinks that we ought to be doing or what we ought to not be doing. So, for example, the decision to own a home, maybe that's a good decision, maybe that's not a good decision, but in the United States, we give tax breaks for state and local taxes, including the property tax. And where I live, the property tax happens to be a big deal. when I tell people elsewhere in the country, including my friend in a London suburb outside the country, how much I pay in property tax, they tend to fall off their chairs. So we shouldn't, so obviously we all like charitable deductions, but we think that charity is more a function of how much disposable income people have than it is whether or not they get a tax break for giving to charities that the government happens to approve. We have to go through a process to get, at the risk of techno talk, we're talking to 501c3, which is the organization that qualifies for a charitable deduction. It's about a 20-page or 30-page application, and it requires the charity to disclose an awful lot to the government, disclose donors and things like that. And I guess I'm getting away from fairness to intrusion, and I apologize for that. But I think it's there's a number of ways that we think that the income tax is not fair, and it's better to a better way to raise revenue is to put out a tax that's absolutely neutral. It doesn't favor one group over another, and just collects revenue, gives a reasonable break to those who are unable to pay the tax. And above that, everybody just pays at the same rate, in our case, above the poverty level.
So on the, the discussion on the income tax, I mean, it sounded, if I were to summarize what you just said, you know, really the income tax allows government to reward people whose way of life they approve of and sort of, I wouldn't say directly punish, but not give those same benefits to a way of life they don't approve of, right?
I agree with that, yes.
Yeah, and then we've also got the whole problem of the enormous discrimination against various groups, of which, you know, I think Americans abroad would probably be exhibit number one, right? Because, you know, not only are they, you know, taxed when they don't live in the United States, but they're also actually subjected to a far more punitive tax. Now, so sales taxes, when I was reading your material this morning, what I think I understood it to say is that 23% sales tax, that's the end of the matter. Is that correct?
That's correct. What the fair tax does is it replaces, and I reiterate the word replaces, and again, at the word risk of techno talk, subtitles A, B, and C of the American Internal Revenue Code. So subtitle A is all income taxes, including wage taxes, capital gains, interest, dividends. Alternative minimum tax. So that all goes by the wayside. Subtitle B is the estate gift and generation skipping taxes. For most people, that's not a major item because the threshold is $5 million now, or well, it's more than that. It's about
It's going to be very short.
Yeah, back to fairly. Yeah. One of the most significant ones that people aren't acutely aware of is subtitle C, which is your wage taxes and your self-employment taxes. So basically, those are the taxes that are taken out of every working person's paycheck. To pay for Social Security, that's our American pension system, and to pay for Medicare. And so those are the three taxes that go away, and they're replaced dollar for dollar. So I think this is an important point. The fair tax is revenue neutral. So it raises just as much revenue for the federal government as the taxes that it does away with on all new tangible goods and all services. So new and tangible are important. We don't tax intangibles. And they that are sold at retail to a consumer in the United States. So there's no tax on business-to-business transactions. There's no tax on exports. So macroeconomically, the benefit to that is that the United States becomes the world's tax haven, competitive with the Cayman Islands, the Cook Islands, Singapore, and places like that, even Hong Kong. And so there's a macroeconomic explosion. Now, you did mention the word sales tax, and to some people, sales tax, that word is poison, because they say, and I think in many cases rightly, that a sales tax burdens people at the lower end of the economic spectrum more than it benefits people who are well-to-do. So we have several ways that we make up for that. First of all, the ways that are not so obvious is we remove the tax component of the cost of services and goods in the United States, as well as the tax compliance component. So the pre-tax prices of goods and services drops before we impose the tax.
Now, actually, I want to keep you on that point for just a second, because it does seem to me that's important. If I may just sort of interject here. One thing that's contemplated by the fair tax is no more tax filing. Agreed?
That's correct. For the consumer. Now, a retailer does have to file a sales tax return, which most retailers file anyway.
That's right.
Except in five states.
Okay. So in other words, it's not really adding to the burden of the retail. I mean, anybody in business has these problems, okay, for sure. Mm-hmm. But what it does do is it removes the, what is this, April 15th? It removes the April 15th horror show every year where people have to find a tax preparer that they trust understands the rules well enough to not mess up the tax return. And even then they still do, right?
That, yes, it does. So it gets rid of the April 15th filing deadline. It gets rid of the tax compliance costs. And it also gets rid of another tax that it gets rid of is the payroll tax. I think I may have mentioned that. I apologize.
Yeah, so that's Subtitle C.
Yeah, that's Subtitle C. And that's what every wage earner pays for Social Security and Medicare. We don't do away with the programs because they're funded through this new sales tax, but we do away with the tax. Now, employers still have to report wage income to the Social Security Administration. But because we do away with these taxes, we do away with the IRS and phase out its funding over a three-year period because we no longer need the IRS to administer these taxes, so that taxes are collected by state sales tax authorities who get 25 basis points for their trouble. And by the way, the merchants who collect the tax at the retail level get 25 basis points for their trouble. So it's merchants to the states, and the states remit to a federal sales tax bureau, which is about 5% of its former self in the form of the IRS. And another thing I'd like to get into is another way that we make the tax fair to everyone. And that is, you probably read when you looked at the website about something we call in our jargon a prebate. The formal name for it is family consumption allowance. But every household in America whose members are lawful residents get a payment at the beginning of the month from the Social Security Administration. Now, why do they get this payment? The purpose of the payment is to untax that household for tax that they pay on consumption up to the poverty level. We don't means test it because we don't want to punish people for improving themselves, but every household gets it, and it's based on family size. It's not based on income. So in effect, what you have with the fair tax is that nobody in America who's lawfully here, that is a U.S. citizen or a non-citizen who went through the process of qualifying him or herself to live in the United States, nobody pays a dime of tax up to the poverty level, which you can't say today. And above the poverty level, everybody in the United States pays tax on consumption, which you have a certain amount of control over, at the same rate. So that's why we think that our tax is fair, even though it's a consumption tax. And it's a little bit hard for some people to get their arms around it, but we think that the fair tax is a way that once it comes into effect, we think that people will like it. And there's a provision in the legislation to get rid of what we call the 16th Amendment to our Constitution. and the 16th Amendment, unless Congress and the states fail to repeal the amendment to the Constitution, then the fair tax sunsets, and Congress has to cast about for a way to fund the government.
Okay. Now, it sounds just too simple, logical, and reasonable for the average mind, right? I mean, this is the problem, right? But the way you're describing the revenue, so basically everybody inside the United States, pays a consumption tax, and that's how it's funded. You know, when you said citizen or resident, isn't it really just anybody in the United States who spends money as, you know, part of this revenue-raising machine?
Yeah, John, that's an excellent point, because everybody who's in the United States, whether legally or not, who spends money, pays the tax, the only people who get this refund at the beginning of the month are people who are lawfully here. But foreign tourists who stay in a hotel in New York overnight, they pay the tax.
Yeah. You know, that's fascinating, right, on a number of different levels. But the first level it's fascinating on is that it actually ties taxation to physical presence in the United States, right?
Yes, that's one thing that U.S. citizens who live abroad should like about it, because IRS.
It just, you know, the system wouldn't apply to them unless they went there.
And I know that Americans now who live abroad, this wasn't the case when I lived there, but Americans have a problem opening bank accounts in foreign countries, because many banks in foreign countries don't want to deal with the plethora of regulations imposed by the United States because they're opening an account for a U.S. citizen.
Oh, yeah.
So that all goes away.
If I were a foreign bank, I would want nothing to do with them, absolutely nothing to do with them. They're nothing but trouble. But now, on a more conceptual theoretical level, and I ask you this because I know you think about taxation probably not 24/7, but 25 or 26/7, something like that. Okay, so I think this may be a fair question for you. But the way you describe this, really, you're describing the U.S. moving to a territorial tax system. In other words, a tax is only income with a connection to the United States and only in the form of sales taxes, right? So it's really, you know, it's territorial, right?
That's
correct.
Because
they're no longer taxing activity outside the United States, right?
That's correct. We stop exporting our law outside the United States.
Oh my God. I mean, that might be the reason they wouldn't want to do it. I mean, let's hurt ourselves as long as we can export our laws, right?
That's right.
But that's really interesting. Now, this morning, as I was perusing your stuff with great interest, I came across a LinkedIn article that you wrote about 4 years ago where you were talking about, I think the gist of it, you were talking about Ireland, you were talking about Hungary, you know, with low corporate tax rates. And the gist of it was that, well, you know, the lower the corporate tax rate, the more likely and legitimate the investment would go to those places. But I mean, really, you know, this completely undercuts any country that has an income tax at all, right?
John, that's a great point, because I think the United States for a while was only number two in terms of its tax rate, and especially particularly the corporate and business tax rate. And I think Japan lowered its income, its tax rate, so that makes us number one again. And we have this phenomenon called inversion. Now, in Canada, you have a chain of stores called Tim Hortons. I think we haven't seen so many of them on this side of the border. But Tim Hortons happens to be the parent company of Burger King. And it used to be that Burger King was the parent company of Tim Hortons, but Burger King got tired of paying tax on its extraterritorial income. So it pulled a...
It renounced its citizenship.
Yeah. Sorry.
You know, it terminated its U.S. tax. I mean, this is an amazing thing, right? Because, you know, I think the conventional understanding, wisdom, view of the world, what have you, is that these big U.S. companies, they go out and they acquire, you know, these foreign companies, right? But in fact, what that high U.S. corporate tax rate was doing was sending American companies cap in hand to foreign companies saying, please acquire us.
That's precisely right. And because most countries, including Canada, I think make more money on their value added tax, which Canada, I understand, has at the federal 13%. Level. Maybe they call it the GST, something like that. And so because of that, their corporate and business tax rates are fairly low, and that makes their goods more competitive with our goods in our market. And that makes American goods sold abroad less competitive in those markets. So with the fair tax, we flip that all around. And if the tax rate in the United States is zero, people start investing in the United States because it's a tax haven. And maybe there might be other reasons why we can't produce things cheaper than we can in India, but at least the tax component is out of the cost of providing goods and services. So we become very competitive.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think that, for anybody in Canada listening to this, take note. Canada is a very, very, I don't think there's anything worse than the U.S. tax system and its complexity. But in terms of the overall rate of taxation in Canada, sure, the corporate rates are lower. I'm glad you're sitting down because you may not know this, but the top personal rates in a number of Canadian provinces exceeds 50%. Okay. And you reach that level at a far lower, level of income generally, and they have a 13% value added tax, right? So, that's extraordinary. Now, I remember Canada actually created the value added tax in conjunction with the Canada-US Free Trade Agreement in the late 80s. And part of the reason for creating the value added tax was in response to lower the cost of Canadian goods, being sold to the United States, because they had all this, horrible costly apparatus before, all of which is to say that this stuff matters, and there's a tremendous sort of flow through with this kind of stuff. All right. So now you've definitely sold me. But I believe in simplicity. I actually believe in simplicity more than I believe in the amount of income that's taxed. I actually, because the complexity of this is so costly. But it also seems to me that moving to a sales tax, a consumption-based tax, just think of the amount of anxiety that would be, how much less anxiety the American people would feel. They wouldn't have to think about the IRS every day. They wouldn't have to worry about sending a Christmas card to their tax preparer. They wouldn't have to worry every time, there's a flu epidemic or something, whether their tax preparer got it. Just think how much nicer life would be without all this apparatus. So why is it so hard to get traction on this?
I think that's a good question. And if you think about it, we think that the people who are most opposed to it are the people who have the most vested interest in the income tax system. And I'll tell you a little anecdote. When the fair tax first got started, it was because three businessmen in Houston who were on Fortune 100 boards sat down and started talking about how much time they spent at board meetings talking about taxes. And they thought that if they could find a tax system that would let them spend close to 100% of their time talking about business issues, they could make goods and services that were more competitive with in foreign markets and more responsive to the wants and needs of consumers. So Leo Lindbeck, who was perhaps our main founder, tried to lobby in Washington for this tax. He found a friendly congressman at that time, John Linder, who dropped the bill in, and it's been a bill in Congress ever since. And he found that the big problem was that there were lobbyists who just had too much invested in the income tax system. And some of the Fortune 100 companies that he expected to get support from, he found that they had a privileged perch because of their ability to lobby, as opposed to the ability of mom and pop shops and other kinds of entities. So he ended up saying goodbye to the lobbyists because he was spending too much money on that and not getting anything from it, and decided to make this into a grassroots movement. But we found that in dealing with Congress, it's not just Democrats who oppose the bill. It's the leadership of the Republican Party, because they like things just the way they are. They can give out benefits they can spend money through the tax code and give privileges to certain constituents and maybe punish other constituents who oppose them politically. So the fair tax would take away their ability to do that. So it's a powerful group that we're up against. And so I think if I had to attribute something as to the main reason why we're not getting as much traction as we ought to, I think that would be a good place to place the responsibility.
You know, I think you're right. And I've often mentioned, I'm talking to you from downtown Toronto, about four blocks from here is the, sort of corner of the business sector of Toronto. And there's these four huge skyscrapers, 60, 70 story buildings there. And, one of them is, I guess you pay for the branding rights, KPMG, this sort of stuff, right? One night, walking down in the middle of the night, and I looked up and somebody said to me, "What goes on in those buildings?" And I thought about it for a minute. I said, all they do is they fill out forms. That's it. I mean, varying degrees of complexity, but just think of, how many it would end the role of the tax lawyer, right? And the accountant, wouldn't it? Or at least severely diminish it. Wouldn't that, I don't know about you, Jim. We're both apparently lawyers, but would it be fair for me to say that most people don't want lawyers in their lives?
Yeah, John, you bring up a really interesting point. One of the members of our board is a partner at a big four public accounting firm here in the United States. He'd prefer that I not say which firm it is, not because he doesn't want his firm to know, but he's concerned that since his firm isn't officially endorsing our tax, that it might confuse the public. But I think you're absolutely right. There are a lot of accountants and a lot of lawyers whose careers are made with the tax code. I would say, fortunately for those people, they tend to be highly educated, and there are other areas that they can move into within their own professions. And some of the people I know who think that this is a great idea happen to be accountants, because I think accountants have more fun growing their clients' businesses than they do trying to game the tax code. And I think a lot of them would love it if we had this, because then they could they could apply their services to more productive endeavors. So I think it's a Yeah, I think at the moment you do have a lot of lawyers and accountants whose careers depend on the complexity of our tax code.
I think that's definitely true, but there's certainly a minority, relative to all the poor individuals who are have this pain and this insanity inflicted on them, and it's not just once a year. It's basically 24/7, because they have to run their lives, according to this. I find it amazing that, a lot of these are really great people who I know, but, they write columns, like tax columns, what kind of a world are we living in where tax is so prevalent that you can actually have a column, a designated tax column, in a publication or something? Don't you think that means it's completely out of control?
Absolutely. Wage earners, though, I think if you talk, I've seen two reactions. One, if you talk to a wage earner who earns a moderate amount of income, they see the tax code as a piggy bank, because their own money is being withheld. But on April 15th or before April 15th, when they file their tax return, they get a refund. When I was with the state of New Jersey, we liked that, because if they owed any money to the state of New Jersey, we got to glom the refund. So I didn't mind that so much. But in my office, we had a significant number of, at the clerical level, African-American personnel. And one woman I talked to, I described the fair tax to her, and she said, "I want to sign on. What do I have to do?" And I said, "You do know, don't you, that prices could rise somewhat, not the full 23% tax inclusive, but they could rise somewhat due to the tax that you're going to pay at retail." And she said, "I don't care, because I don't want to get money taken out of my paycheck." So there is the offset of getting money taken out that they no longer have taken out of the paycheck, and they have discretion over how they can spend it. But yeah, I think, but anybody who's in a small business has to spend a lot of money. I think one dentist, our dentist once said that he had to spend more money on accountants than he owed in taxes. So there's something upside down when people say that.
That is, I think, 98% of Americans abroad would be in that category. It's unbelievable. And as I say, it's a completely separate form, penalty laden. So I mean, you can't even imagine, you know, that the how intrusive and the forms that are required with this stuff. But, you know, I mean, I think that I think the compliance for these tax systems, and I don't mean just the United States, I would include Canada, although it's not as bad, is so great that in itself is a reason to, you know, for complete tax reform. And the other thing is that, I mean, finance ministers the world over agree that consumption taxes are a far more reliable form of government revenues, right?
Absolutely. The basis, I don't want to give a percentage, but the base is significantly more stable than the income tax and the payroll tax base. So governments, one of the benefits to that is that because of the lack of volatility, politicians tend to spend less money when the economy is good, and they don't have so much in social spending to spend when the economy has a downturn.
Right.
I was in Chile for other reasons, but I happened to meet with the director of tax policy, and he was very interested in what I said. Now his government is out. They have another government in there now, but I think it's they have some very interesting income tax policies. But it was something that that he listened to with a great deal of interest.
So let me ask you a question. Have you ever? I mean, so you and I would both agree that taxes are hugely significant, not only for revenue raising measure, but in how people's lives are, how societies are, and ultimately, you know, I think largely the history of countries can be defined in terms of taxation. Would you agree?
I think so. If you look at companies that make certain decisions for tax reasons instead of for business reasons, it shows that taxes have a very distorting effect on economies. And individuals have to behave the same way. And if people were just allowed to pay a consumption tax and then make their own decisions free of tax considerations, I think you would have a much more balanced society.
Yeah, and in fact, you know, a tax scholar by the name of Charles Adams, who was writing in the 90s, he's an interesting guy. He was actually a California tax lawyer, moved to Toronto, wrote a book called For Good and Evil, Taxes and Civilization. Basically, his thesis is that the history of civilization of countries can largely be described in terms of tax policies, right? I mean, he was like 30, 40 years ahead of his time, but you know, when you read this, I mean, that book, which I highly recommend to you, is probably Exhibit A, probably the best argument there is for adopting the fair tax, the consumption tax. I mean, the bottom line is that taxation just cannot be so prevalent in a healthy society, right?
I certainly agree. Because with the fair tax, it would be simple. Retail sales merchants and sellers of services would have a very simple reform to fill out. It would probably be one page long, and it's what's your gross sales? This is your tax. And then there are certain credits, but basically that would be about it. And for the individual, there'd be no federal tax to fill out. And we think that many states in the United States, and maybe if Canada adopted the equivalent of it, many provinces in Canada would enact what we call conforming state and provincial taxes, where the tax base is the same and it's much easier to track. States would cooperate with each other on tracking sales, interstate sales. And then I think we would have, it would just be a simpler way to run the government, and the government would have a steady stream of income, and I think the clouds would disappear and the sun would come out.
Well, actually, Canada has that. Maybe it's just because there's only 10 provinces, but this is one of the things that I find just absolutely astonishing about the U.S. tax system. You know, is that not only do we have, I don't even think there's a close second in complexity, the most complex tax system in the world, but then you have all this craziness going on the state levels, and many of those states do not follow, at least in all respects, right? You know, the U.S. tax rules, the federal tax rules. That's so, right. I mean, it's a problem that is so great that it's as though the government, because of taxation, is now so big that it's almost enslaved the country by this stuff.
Sure. Yeah. There are six states in the United States that have no personal income tax, the biggest among them being Texas and Florida. And the states, if we gauge economic growth by growth in congressional seats, those two states would be Texas and Florida. So people obviously want to move there, not just for the sunshine, but for economic reasons. I know my parents moved to Florida from New Jersey because my father didn't want to pay estate taxes.
Estate taxes.
Yes. State income taxes.
What level they kick in there?
Yeah, he was doing estate planning, and by moving to Florida, he didn't have to worry about transfer inheritance tax or estate taxes in Florida, as well as income tax. And Florida had what's called an intangibles tax, and they even got rid of that. Now, we have three states in the United States that are looking at true fair tax proposals at the state level. It's Alabama, Georgia, and Nebraska. Nebraska even considering a constitutional amendment to eliminate state taxes at all levels except a sales tax, and with the fair tax style prebate and everything that goes along with it. So we think that this is the biggest hope that we have. If we can get at least one of those states up on the scoreboard to enact a state-level fair tax and show that it works and it's successful, we think that will put pressure on other states and upward pressure on the federal government. So it's a long shot, but we're working very hard at it.
Yeah, you know what? Joe Howard has just entered the room here. Let's bring Joe into the conversation here. Does it sound good?
Sure.
Hello.
Hi, Joe. How are you doing? Yeah, so Jim and I have actually been talking for almost an hour, so I just wanted to jump in and say that this is being recorded. Okay, so welcome for at least the last few minutes of this, but I wanted to let you know that you were live and being recorded, okay?
So Joe, pleasure to meet you.
It's nice to meet you, Jim. How are you doing?
Very good, thanks. We've been having a great conversation.
Am I late?
Well, I guess so. We started an hour ago, but we've got a few minutes left. And, you know, one of the great things here is that, of course, the fair tax really means that there's no such thing as tax residency, that, you know, people just pay tax, a sales tax, wherever they buy the product. So that certainly would solve the problems of one group of people who I think you know. And therefore, I think that probably the community of Americans abroad should, you know, if they're listening to this, should take down Jim's phone number you know, and join the movement immediately. But yeah. So, you know, continuing.
Yeah, I've been looking at the. I'm sorry.
So continuing our conversation, you know, the when we look at the competitiveness of the states relative to one another, what we're also seeing is a number of states getting very, very aggressive on trying to enforce tax residency, and in some cases trying to impose exit taxes. I don't know, Jim, if you're familiar with this proposal coming out of California about a year ago, where, you know, they're basically trying to, you know, if I'm understanding this correctly, tax the assets of people who left California, whether they're California assets or not, for 10 years or something.
I hate to say something that's inflammatory. Maybe I shouldn't, but that sounds to me like what they would have called in the 30s a Reichsflugsteuer.
So. Actually, possibly worse.
Yeah.
If you look at the Reichsflugsteuer, and this is something that, I mean, I'm generally interested in exit taxes. Maybe that would be a good subject for a podcast sometime. In fact, it would be a good subject for a podcast. But, you know, admittedly, all of these things need to be understood in the in their historical context. But the Reichsflugsteuer as a tax concept was actually less than what's going on in America today. It was the way that administered it. Way it was administered that made it so punitive. But that's exactly right. Yeah, you know, you leave, we're going to take your assets. And of course, I don't know if you're aware of this, probably not, because it could never affect you. But one of the changes since you were an expat is that Americans who try to renounce U.S. citizenship can be subject to extraordinarily punitive exit taxes. Including, you know, just straight taxes on their non-U.S. pensions. I mean, it's shocking. It is shocking. In fact, the current state of the U.S. expatriation tax would make it more punitive, at least for Americans abroad, than any equivalent ever enacted.
Yeah, I understand that. Well, about 4 or 5 years ago, the number of Americans who were, but both Americans who were renouncing their citizenship and permanent non-citizen residents of the United States who were giving up their residency permits had hit a record. I mean, obviously it was small in the overall scheme of American taxation, but the rate of increase was quite significant. And, I would think it would be because of the notion that one is subject to taxation in a country where one doesn't maintain a residence or spend any time. So my sympathies are certainly with those who.
That's amazing stuff. And it's why, even if an income tax is to continue, it's why citizenship has absolutely got to be severed from the definitions of tax residency. I mean, it's madness that just because somebody's born in the United States, they're subject not only to the Internal Revenue Code, but to the parts of it that are by far the most punitive, even if they have no connection to the United States. It's absolutely shocking.
Yeah, I would agree. And we have the answer. What I would urge people listening to the podcast to do is to do, John, what you did. Go to www.fairtax.org and learn as much as you can. And U.S. expats can now do something that I wasn't able to do when I was an expat. They can vote for federal office in the last place in the United States to which they had a connection. So if I were to move back to Germany and retain my U.S. citizenship, I could vote for federal office. I could vote for president and I could vote for senators and for my congressman in the 7th District of New Jersey. And maybe if there's some coordinated way for expats to get together, they might be able to make their voices heard. And I would be 100% behind that.
I think that's a wonderful idea. I mean, would you agree that given the how important this issue is, that, I mean, first of all, you know, I think that this is better seen as a non, this tax stuff is better seen as a nonpartisan issue, right? I mean, as long as this kind of insane tax system exists, it doesn't make any difference whether it's the Democrats, whether or greed, you know, they're going to keep doing harm, maybe in somewhat different ways, but they're going to keep doing harm. So it would seem to me, you know, when you talk about the voting opportunity and perhaps power of Americans abroad, they really should think in terms of how to best use their vote to get change on this severing citizenship from tax residency and or, you know, the adoption of, you know, of your fair tax. Would that make sense? In other words, don't vote for a Democrat, don't for a Republican, vote for the candidate.
Absolutely. And when we got started, we had a rule that if somebody came on to co-sponsor the fair tax, when we had only eight or so co-sponsors, that person had to bring on somebody from the opposite party. So back then, we had an equal number of Republicans and Democrats, and we are truly a nonpartisan organization. We just want the, we're just advocating for our particular piece of legislation. And maybe another area to pressure would be there are organizations called American Citizens Abroad, and I'm trying to think of a,
We've been working on this issue, you know, for a long time. That's right. Yeah. Or the, you know, you mentioned a couple of times how the voting rules changed. That was actually attributable to the work of AARO, American Association of Residents Overseas, who worked on that problem for some years. But yeah, those are two groups who, in, you know, in different ways, I think, have been supportive of this. Let me ask you this. I mean, given the importance of taxation and all this, what about turning the Fair Tax Group into a political party?
We've talked about that, to form a PAC. We haven't had the money to do that yet. I think the problem is, as a political party, Americans are too, I don't think that forming one in direct competition with Republicans and Democrats, which are the two major parties, would get very far. We'd be like libertarians or constitutionalists, or, and we'd never get anybody elected. We think we're more effective trying to, right now we're trying to educate the public and get a grassroots organization to pressure congresspeople to co-sponsor. And right now it's HR 25 in the House of Representatives. We've talked now and then about forming a PAC, and for a number of reasons, we just haven't gone forward with it, but it's still an interesting idea.
Well, it may be that its time is going to come because, you know, basically, I think this has gotten so bad that I think the very survival of the United States is actually dependent on a rational discussion about taxation and tax reform. You know, it's, you know, I think a pivotal moment in history for a lot of reasons. And you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to send you a copy of Charles Adams' book. I mean, they're all used at this point. I'll get it off one of the sites, but I'm going to send this to you.
Well, thank you.
Have a look, and we can, you know, we can pick up on this. You know, we've been going now for about an hour, so it's probably should bring this to an end. But Joe, do you have any particular thoughts or questions you want to ask Jim or whatever before we sign off for today? Or
sure. So you two have been talking for an hour now. I came in late. Sorry about that. So my question to you, Jim, is this. How long have you known about the issue involving U.S. citizens living abroad and taxation?
Interesting. I went into the Army JAG Corps in 1974. So at that point, when I went as a member of the U.S. Armed Forces up into Germany, I was not subject to German taxation because of the treaties between the two countries, but I was one of the small number of people who got out of the Army and stayed in Germany because I had a job offer from an insurance company in Cologne. And when that happened, I met the full brunt of double taxation of American citizens. So I would say 1970, I knew about it as an intellectual intellectual concept, but I would say that 1977 was when I began feeling the full effect of it.
That's interesting because, yeah, a lot of people don't realize that the U.S. citizenship-based taxation system has been going after Americans abroad even before 2010 and before the 1990s. It's been happening for about 100 years. It's just a lot of Americans, homeland Americans, didn't even know about it. Not even Americans abroad knew about it. Come out until Barack Obama's 2010 FATCA law went out there and just ruined everything for Americans abroad. So I believe that right there is what opened the door for everyone to become knowledgeable about what was going on. And you know, it's still like that. A lot of people don't know that citizenship-based taxation exists, but more know about it today than they did in the past, thanks to FATCA.
Yeah, Joe, I think you're right. When I was living in Germany, we hosted a couple. He was German, she was an American. And I don't think she knew about it. And what I explained to her was, as long as she was in Germany, the United States wouldn't be able to enforce the Internal Revenue Code, but she better not fly to Kennedy Airport because then she'd be exposing herself to a lot of legal trouble. And I was also talking with my wife's cousin, who happens to be the county clerk of Union County, New Jersey, where I live. And I explained that if she were to go to Italy as an American citizen and just move there, she'd still have to file an American tax return. And she didn't want to believe it. So it's I think there's an education process that needs to take place, and you're doing a great job.
Yeah, I also have to thank Seat and Arrow for that too. They've been very helpful getting information out there. I started learning about citizenship-based taxation in 2017 while living in the United States. And knowing the challenges, I still moved overseas because I just felt like, I can't let these immoral laws just lock me down and control me. And best move I ever made. And I'm very knowledgeable about what's going on today. And I just want to help people. And see Arrow and some other organizations have been helpful. So, you know, there's information out there. You just got to know the best way to research it and where to go. And I believe that the Fair Tax Act would be nice, too. I think that would really fix a lot of issues.
And what I encourage people to do is go to the website, scroll down to get information, and put your contact information there. We don't sell the list, so you're not going to get spammed. And if you're in the United States, put your full address. Well, I guess put your full address anyway, whether you're in the United States or not. But the advantage to an American putting his or her full address there is that way we know what congressional district you're in. And if we have a campaign where we want to target somebody, a congressman in this particular district, then we know you're there and we know you can help us.
Yeah, I've actually been sending messages to my representative in Ohio, Mike Turner. So he's in Dayton, Ohio, and I never heard back from him. I've been trying to get in contact with him since 2018. So about
not even a form letter?
A whole bunch of issues. Excuse me?
Not even a form letter or form communication?
Nope.
One more argument for the fair tax. One more argument for the fair tax. Yeah, interesting. All right. We haven't going more than an hour. So I'm thinking maybe we should wrap this up at least for now. Unless, Joe, do you have anything specific you want to add at this point, since you're?
Not right now. I kind of came in late, so I think next time I'll come in on time and be able to get some things out there, but I don't really have much to say right now.
Okay. Jim, closing thoughts. You want to reinforce again where people can get information?
Sure. Thank you so much for having me on your podcast. I'm honored to do that and be on. And yes, please go to www.fairtax.org and go to the website. We do have research and we have information about the bill. The book that I first read was called The Fair Tax Book by John Linder and Neil Bortz. That was I think that is an easy read. It's less than 200 pages and it's very light. But I think especially for Americans living abroad, this is something that you need to get behind because we hear you. We understand what your problems are because I've been there and I understand it. So go to fairtax.org and let me know, jim.bennett@fairtax.org, if you have any comments or questions.
Wonderful. All right. Well, let's wrap this up for now. Jim, I'd love to have a part two with you on these topics down the road.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for organizing this. A huge shout out to you. And Jim, thanks for taking the time out of your day.